You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a doctor and public health expert joins the show to answer your questions about COVID-19 and what's being done to slow the spread of the novel coronavirus. Now, Wisconsin will join the growing number of states with some version of a stay-in-place order for residents to help contain the spread of the novel coronavirus. Governor Tony Evers announced this morning via Twitter he would be ordering Wisconsinites to limit their travel outside the home to just emergencies and essentials. The full order is expected to come tomorrow. WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson joins us now. Sean, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob.
Well, the governor had a press conference earlier today where he offered some clarification. What do we know, first of all, about why he's made this order toward the end of last week? He said he was hoping to avoid something like this.
He said that after he talked to more health professionals that he, he didn't want to do something like this in the first place, but the more that he talked to them, he became convinced that this is the best way to slow the spread of the coronavirus. That there are still too many people out there, out and about, in crowds, kind of not taking it seriously enough, and that this would be the next step for him.
I know there are still details we're watching for to be hammered out, but as of right now, Sean, what do we know about what this means?
I would say there's a lot of details that we do not know right now. Let's start with what we know will remain open for sure. And I think it's important to hear that, grocery stores and pharmacies will remain open. And the governor said today that there will be many other businesses that will remain open. So this is not a complete shutter of the state of Wisconsin. There will be businesses that are deemed essential by the state that will be allowed to remain open. And the Evers administration stressed, you don't need to go out today and rush to buy groceries because we're not shutting grocery stores. So that's kind of what we know as to which businesses are on that list of essential businesses that will remain open. That we're still waiting to find out. The governor says that that's still being worked out. It's going to be ordered tomorrow, but I don't know when the order will take effect. It's going to be released tomorrow, the governor says, but he didn't give any idea of what the timeline would be for when it would be in place.
Just to hammer that point home, grocery stores open today, they'll be open tomorrow, and under this order, they can stay open on Wednesday and beyond.
They will stay open. Yes, under this order, grocery stores will stay open. So you don't need to rush to the store today to get the last, food on the shelf, because grocery stores will be open under this order that is coming tomorrow.
Now, we had heard over the last week some legislative leaders on the Republican side of things praising Governor Evers for not doing a wider shutdown. Have we heard response from them so far today?
They were pretty critical of the governor today, yes. This is kind of the first time that we've seen Republican leaders and a lot of rank-and-file Republican lawmakers, too, criticizing the governor. I think it seems like they're bigger issue with the governor, at least in their written statement, is that his announcement had created confusion. We know that the governor is going to be issuing, a stay-at-home order or a safer-at-home order. We don't know what that means. Speaker Robin Voss and Scott Fitzgerald, the Senate Majority Leader, said in a statement, quote, "The governor's executive order came as a surprise to the legislature." They said that it created, quote, "mass amounts of confusion." So that's where they're at on this right now.
We're talking to WPR State Capitol reporter Sean Johnson about Governor Evers announcing that he would start a safer at home order tomorrow, probably closing more businesses, though essential ones will stay open. Still waiting for details on what exactly it means tomorrow. Now, we had a call updating the status of the state's response to COVID-19. I want to listen to Governor Evers now speaking on that call about this decision.
This was not something I felt strongly that we needed to do, but since I communicate regularly with our great healthcare staff as well as other medical and healthcare professionals, They have significantly suggested to me that this is the best way to curb the virus, that we were not getting to the point where we wanted to be.
And that, points out something the governor's trying to do here, even if not much changes. It seems like he's using on Twitter and in these announcements, trying to have a little bit of a bully pulpit to get people to take this more seriously.
Yes, he is in, you know, the city of Milwaukee issued a similar order today. It's, you know, it will be superseded by the state order, but they kind of viewed it as a way to get the word out to people, the Milwaukee mayor did, as a way to get the word out to people that they need to take this more seriously. It is interesting that the governor issued this, you know, it's not the order, but announced that he would be issuing this order on his official Twitter account. So that was sort of the, I guess, the news of record there for a while. And really, in his prepared remarks today, they mirrored a lot of what he said on Twitter. And if you're looking for clues about what the governor wants to restrict here, he said, quote, "Unfortunately, that means no sleepovers, no playdates, no dinner parties with friends and neighbors. You can still get out and walk the dogs, limit your travel to essential needs like going to the doctor, groceries, medication. And if you go outside, stay 6 feet away from others and in shared spaces like parks, shelters, and visitor centers." So some hints there at what he's looking for, but again, looking for a lot of specifics hopefully tomorrow.
And Sean, the Department of Health in the state, Health Services, has been keeping up on the numbers. What do we know about the scope of coronavirus here in the state, given that the numbers keep changing pretty much every time I say a number on the air?
I know, yeah. The numbers that are on the Department of Health Services website right now, which are where they point us to all the time, is that we have now had 5 deaths from COVID-19 in Wisconsin. There have been 416 positive tests and more than 7,000 negative tests. These are numbers as of today released by the Department of Health Services. So I think the thing that they're stressing, the thing you hear health officials stressing on the national level, is that people can have COVID-19 and not show symptoms and spread it in the community, and then more vulnerable populations can have more serious symptoms and they can catch it that way. So that's the message they stressed again today as they release these latest numbers.
We'll be talking to Dr. Patrick Remington, a public health expert here in the state, more about the impact of these kind of measures. Sean, in news from the legislature, I understand one state representative, David Bowen from Milwaukee, put out a release today saying he's tested positive for COVID-19. So we've been watching this at the national level, federal lawmakers. Now we're seeing it with at least one state lawmaker now.
Yeah, and it's interesting. David Bowen is 33 years old, and he said in his statement that he put out today, even if you're young and healthy, it's even more important that you heed the call to stay home, take care of your family, and not spread the virus to others who are vulnerable. He is our first example in state government. We also found out last week that Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett, he was not a positive case of COVID-19, but he had gone into quarantine because he'd been in contact with somebody who had it.
And we heard last hour, Sean, when we were talking to a couple officials from the Department of Workforce Development, state lawmakers have introduced a bill requested by Governor Evers to shorten the waiting period for unemployment insurance. Are we seeing any other action from the, I guess, not really in session legislature right now?
You know, until this kind of dust up today between Evers and Republican leaders, they had been, you know, fairly complimentary of one another, and they had been meeting pretty regularly. And so, you know, that's the kind of place, those are the types of meetings where you can work out something that would be in a special session or an extraordinary session. And given the numbers of unemployment claims that we've seen in Wisconsin, you know, they may need to do more around that. That last week, there were 69,342 people who filed initial claims for unemployment insurance in Wisconsin. The same week last year, the number was about 5,000. So that's just staggering numbers. I think a lot of what the state lawmakers and the governor are going to have to do is see what Congress does with this, and then they may have to kind of fill in the gaps where there's areas where the state needs to step in.
Sean, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
You bet, Rob. Thank you.
That's WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson. We talked to him today about Governor Evers' announcement that he's ordering Wisconsin residents to avoid unnecessary trips, stay at home as much as possible to contain the spread of the new coronavirus. Essential services and businesses will stay open, including things like grocery stores, obviously health centers, pharmacies, and more. Coming up, after schools in the state closed, one Wisconsin teen moved his daily story time for kids online. He tells us why he wanted to keep it going. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk with a Wisconsin teenager who's live streaming a daily story time for kids while schools around the state remain closed. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher with a story about Wisconsin's late winter sugar maple season.
Every year, without fail, winter has a sweet grand finale. Do you know what it is? It's sugar maple season. Norman Gilliland spent some time among the maple trees and followed the process from sap to syrup.
Dan and Liz and their family have 175 sugar maples just across the line in the UP. About 15 years ago, Dan's father, Ed, began tapping the trees. If you're going to try it, some important pointers. First, it's a good idea to make sure that you actually have a maple tree. And then make sure that the tree is alive. And then there's one more detail from Ed.
It's kind of important that you have the angle of the tap down. And we've had people that have tapped trees and have been slightly angled into the tree and the sap doesn't come out.
Dan's found a promising tree. And if the drilling and tapping go according to plan, you put in a tap and hang up a bucket, and sooner or later, you hear this. Let's put on some snowshoes and go check some trees that were tapped earlier. The average maple tree will produce about 10 or 12 gallons of sap per season. During the warmth of day, starch stored in the roots for the winter rises through the trunk as sugary sap. Tapping doesn't affect the health of the tree. A healthy tree can produce sap for 100 years or more. Let's have a look in some of the buckets. Time now to haul it to the sugar shack, where it's poured into a storage tank.
Okay, so we've collected about 7 gallons of sap on our first run to the trees, and we're going to go back to our storage tank and dump the sap in there, and that's where we'll be collecting it until we're ready to boil.
The family has built a handsome and efficient new sugar shack because a year or so ago at dinner time, the original shack burned down for some reason. From the storage tank, the sap is pumped into the head tank, and from the head tank, it goes into the float pan, which has a device that regulates the depth of the sap in the main evaporator tank, and from there, it flows into the finishing tank, where it reposes in a second float pan. But how are you going to keep the boiler hot? Why doesn't the sap boil over and make a gooey mess all over the floor? For the watchful custodian of the process, there's a simple trick. Poking a match tipped with butter into the hot, bubbling sap, which makes it drop back down like magic. In the float pan, evaporation begins to turn the watery sap into viscous syrup.
And we're ready for what we call a draw. And so the temperature is about 7 degrees above the boiling point of water. And we also use a hydrometer, and if the hydrometer is floating, then we know we have syrup.
Congratulations, you have syrup. But unless you're going to haul it out in buckets, there's one more step in your syrup odyssey. It's convenient to put it in sterile mason jars. It all boils down to this. At the end of the season, by about April 15th, your 175 sugar maples will have yielded you something like 1,200 gallons of sap that you have processed into 30 gallons of potent maple syrup. Now you can kick back and look forward to next year when that otherwise awkward time between winter and spring brings your next chance to reap a sweet reward. In the meantime, bon appetit.
Norman Gilliland is a writer, producer, and host at Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Now, with schools around the state closed, at least for in-person classes, the daily routine for students is looking a lot different. For the younger kids, that means possibly missing out on a daily story time from their teachers or student helpers. Our next guest was taking time each day to read to pre-kindergarten students in his school district before the shutdown. Now he's keeping it going with broadcasts on Facebook Live. Oscar Telshow is a senior at Stratford High School. He hosts Storytime with Oscar weekdays at 11 a.m. It streams on the Facebook page for his family's business, Helene's Hilltop Orchard. Oscar, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it's good to be here with you.
Now, how did you get started reading to kids offline when you first started this? What led you to do that?
So at our school, we have a thing where we can get set up with what we want to do when we're older. So I want to be a teacher. So I was able to get a work experience with the preschool students at the elementary school. So I started going over there every day, and that kind of started everything now.
Yeah, and then schools closed just over a week ago. Everything changed. Why was it important to you to keep this going over on Facebook Live now?
I guess it's kind of one of those things where if they didn't have it, maybe they wouldn't feel normal, but if I keep doing it, make everything feel normal for them, and I guess it just kind of makes sure everybody's on the same page, and we all know it's just going to all be all right in the end.
I was looking at the Facebook Live. It looks like you're getting a lot of views. What's the turnout been like so far?
I think the most I have so far is 3,000 or 2,000.
Wow.
But yeah, every day they just keep getting more and more views, and people are sharing them, and word's getting out about it.
Yeah, I'm guessing you didn't read to 3,000 kids at a time when you were doing it in person.
No. Only about 10 to 12.
Now, what are some of the books you've read so far?
I got all of them on the table still. I'll go read some of the titles here for you.
Sure.
So I read If You Give a Moose a Muffin, The Horse in Harry's Room, There Was an Old Lady Who Swallowed a Shell, Cows Can't Fly, and then today I read I Love You More Than Macaroni and Cheese.
And I understand you don't just do the book. You make time for some extra stuff. What other kinds of things do you include?
This week we're looking to do some baking. Me and my sister are here, so we got free time on our hands, baking supplies, so we're going to do like brownie baking tutorials and things like that.
And there's a joke of the day, right?
Correct, yeah. Today's joke was, how do you get a squirrel to like you?
I don't know.
You act like a nut.
Do the kids respond on Facebook? Do they send you notes about your joke or about the book or with questions or anything?
Yeah, usually they'll comment on it with answers or whatnot. So those come through as the live's moving.
Now, when you broadcast a book reading, I know copyright can be an issue. How are you reaching out to authors to make sure you can read their stuff?
At this point, a lot of the books I've read have been copyright, so it's just I'm going till they catch me there. But the authors I have reached out to, I just email them, and they tell me absolutely 100% you can read my book. And I just use that as an okay from them to use it, I guess.
If there are authors out there listening and they say, hey, I have a good kid's book, can they get in touch with you and send you a copy or email you a copy?
Yeah, they can reach out on the Helene's Hilltop Orchard page, or they can text me or my mom. I can give my phone number to them if they reach out on Helene's, and then we can get in touch from there.
We're talking to Oscar Telshow, senior at Stratford High School. He hosts Storytime with Oscar weekdays at 11 a.m. on the Facebook page for Helene's Hilltop Orchard. Now, Oscar, this is your senior year in high school. And I know a lot of important things are getting canceled as we move along. How are you doing with this new weird reality?
It's tough. Yeah, being a senior, you really feel like you get a lot taken away from you because of this. But, you know, I FaceTime my friends every day, and we're all pretty bummed about it, especially since, you know, it's our senior year, last sports season here for a lot of us. But, you know, we're just taking it step by step, day by day, being as positive as we can.
And doing this story time, Oscar, does that help you feel like you're doing something worthwhile?
Yeah, it feels like, you know, it's just a sick day for me. You know, I keep saying that, like, you know, maybe these kids are just like, he's still reading to us, and I may not be there with them, but I just think of it, I'm sick today. I'll be at school tomorrow, and I just keep thinking that.
What do you know the age range of kids? I know you were reading to pre-K kids earlier. Do you get a sense that it's mostly 3- and 4-year-olds, or are you getting a variety of kids turning out now?
I've had anywhere from 3-year-olds to 10 to 12-year-olds on here.
Are any of your high school buddies tuning in?
Yeah, I got some of my friends on there. They comment to me back and forth.
Cool. I know a lot of things are on hold right now, but what are your plans after graduation, Oscar?
I plan to attend Ripon College, major in education, and run on the track team there. So.
And what's on the table for story time tomorrow? Do you have a book planned yet?
I'm going to read the other book that one of the authors sent me called Mac the Little Lumberjack.
All right. Well, have fun. Thank you so much, and keep it up, Oscar. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Have a good day.
Oscar Telsho is a senior at Stratford High School. He hosts Storytime with Oscar weekdays at 11 a.m. It live streams on the Facebook page for Helene's Hilltop Orchard. Coming up, a public health doctor joins the show to answer your questions about COVID-19 and the efforts to slow down the spread of the disease in Wisconsin and around the world. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, the novel coronavirus is hitting some big cities right now. But what happens if and when it spreads to rural areas with limited healthcare access? Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at telemedicine and how it could help bring care to places that need it. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, Wisconsin has more than 400 cases of COVID-19. 5 Wisconsinites have died from the disease. There have also been thousands of negative tests for COVID-19. Today, Governor Evers announced there would be a safer-at-home order that goes into effect tomorrow, saying it was necessary to help slow down the spread of the virus. We know you have questions as the disease continues to spread and efforts to slow it down kick into high gear. We've been getting a lot of questions from listeners through our Wisconsin portal on Facebook and email, and of course in calls to our talk shows here on the Ideas Network. So right now, a doctor and public health expert joins us to answer some of those questions. You can also call in now with your questions about the novel coronavirus and COVID-19 and public health measures. Are you wondering about the symptoms or the spread, the public health response, how our state's healthcare system is getting ready for the pandemic? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Patrick Remington is Professor Emeritus at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Remington, welcome back to the show.
Good to be back. Thanks, Rob.
Well, Dr. Remington, some of the most frequent questions we've been getting are about testing. As you're watching things, what's the status of the number of tests we have available, the labs we have to process them, and the people who need them?
Well, we clearly, as a country, we're not prepared to test as many people as we should have been. One of the most important things early in an epidemic is to not only test people who are symptomatic, but also test people who might be exposed to people with symptoms, so we can learn more about the ability of the virus to spread, and also the seriousness of the virus. So other countries had more test kits available. Korea, for example, is testing 6 to 10 times more people per capita than we are, and they were way ahead of the curve on knowing more about the virus and really to be able to do what we call sort of public health 101, which is to identify cases, diagnose them through a test, but then follow up aggressively on their contacts, test them also to learn whether they've become infected, and then you can implement isolation and quarantine measures much more intelligently, and we're just playing catch up.
Right. It seems like the countries where we've seen success stories, China after some initial shortcomings, South Korea, as you mentioned, parts of Italy that seem to be doing better. It seems like the common thread, at least according to some public health experts I've read, is, as you said, lots of testing and then isolation. Is it too late for that here now, or is there still room for us if we can ramp things up to replicate what appears to have been successful elsewhere?
No, it's definitely not too late. I think one of the reasons for the stay-at-home or safer-at-home order is to give us time to increase the number of tests. The production of testing has been ramping up, not just through public health laboratories, but private laboratories. So we're seeing a rapid increase in testing. Now, just a caution, when you see a spike in the number of diagnosed cases, that can be from the disease spreading, but it can also be from just more testing. So in places that have ramped up testing, you might see what appears to be a spike in the actual transmission, but that's just more testing. But it's definitely not too late. But to give us time, people should really reduce the risk of transmission by staying home and not going to crowded meetings and using this concept of social isolation.
And before we go to our callers at 800-642-1234, there is some pushback I see, you know, on social media, in the media and elsewhere, saying this isn't that big a deal. It's a flu, something like that. We're overreacting. How would you address that kind of concern?
We are not overreacting. We are reacting. Given the lack of preparedness, it may appear to be overreacting, but we don't really have the public health infrastructure in place to respond like other countries, and we didn't have the capacity in the area of testing. And it doesn't do any good to look back and say that we should have or could have done better. Now is the time to use social isolation to buy us time to have improved testing and also help build back the public health infrastructure. Our local health departments, state health departments, have been struggling with declining budgets, and we just can't do that and be prepared for the next pandemic. We have to learn from this lesson and come into it much better prepared.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We'll start with Fawn on the line in Madison. Fawn, hello.
Callers now at 800-642-1234.
Fawn, are you there?
Fawn, hello.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, turn your radio down, though, Fawn.
Fawn, hello, can you hear me?
Yes, yep, go for it.
Hi, yes. There's been so much misinformation. I've seen all kinds all over social media, like lots and lots of myths. One of the things some of them I've been able to dispel with the help of Snopes, but I wonder about this one. Just how tenacious is the virus? Can it spread? Can it live on our clothes and be carried as we come in from outdoors, for example? If we encounter it out of doors, should we immediately take all our clothes off and wash it? Wash the clothes in hot water, cold water? Should we take a shower immediately? And if can't wash the clothes, then we should set them outside in the sunlight to be neutralized by the UV rays. Can you
gotcha.
Say something about that?
That's a question. I mean, I've wondered myself, Fawn. Thanks for calling in, Dr. Remington. Do we know at this point how the virus can stay alive or stick around on clothing and whether it can be transmitted that way?
Well, we do know that the virus lasts some time on surfaces. If a person were ill and coughed or sneezed, that surface in front of them could contain the virus, and it can last several hours. But whether you can, and there, I've seen these reports that you can find it 9 days later, whether you can recover a virus 9 days later doesn't mean that it's going to be viable and likely to cause infection. I like to think about it as there's no 100% yes and 0% no. There's grades of risk. And if you're a healthcare provider and doing the great work that we need from healthcare providers and taking care of sick patients, you're going to be exposed to the virus, and you're going to do very careful precautions to not carry that virus from room to room or home with you. But if you're in at home and you're going out and going for a walk, or even going shopping at a grocery store, the chance of being exposed to a virus is extremely small, but it's reasonable when you touch surfaces that may not have been clean that you wash your hands. And if you do have surfaces that you've shared with others, like a cell phone, that you do disinfect it. But again, it's not to the point that the virus is living on all possible surfaces, outdoors and in places where people have not been ill.
Thanks for that call, Fawn, at 800-642-1234. Dr. Patrick Remington from the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health is with us answering your questions about COVID-19 and public health measures. Back to your calls now. Ron is with us in Ridgeville. Ron, hello.
Yeah, hi. Hi, Robin. I'm sorry. Hi, Robin, to your guest. I've got a question about the use of hand sanitizers and these other liquids that we're using to treat surfaces. Can this virus eventually, or could it, potential to create resistance to these things that we're using?
Interesting. Thanks for that call, Dr. Remington. Can a virus evolve resistance to these to alcohol?
No, they can't. Viruses, in order to change and to mutate, which they do, this virus mutates probably every two or three times it infects a population, maybe every 2 weeks or so. But those mutations so far have not changed the characteristic of the virus or yet. We don't see a change in its sort of immune receptor. And we think, therefore, it, at least the evidence is right as of today, that that isn't the type of mutation that might make it less remedied by a vaccine. But disinfectants kill the virus. They're not replicating outside of a human, and so there's no chance of resistance. The virus will dry and die within a couple of hours, but disinfectants can kill it much quicker.
Thanks for that call. And people might think of antibacterial soaps, which has nothing to do with viruses, but it is true, right, that use of antibacterial soaps, bacteria sometimes could develop resistances. Is that right?
That's true, because they're replicating on a surface or on a contaminated product in a contaminated product. And that's different. Viruses are not replicating outside of a human host. So that is true. Certainly the use of antibiotics within people or within animals can lead to resistance, but it's not the case for viruses.
Thanks for that call. We'll go now to Tyler with us in Appleton. Tyler, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I guess I have two questions. One is, what do you think the possibility is of the American public receiving the remdesivir and the chloroquine as possible treatments? And also, do you foresee any problems with the potential patents that are with the COVID-19 testing kits and even with the virus itself?
Thanks for that call, Tyler. Dr. Remington, let's start with a couple drugs that people are talking about. Other countries are trying. Here in the U.S., we're experimenting with them, I think.
Well, I take my advice from Tony Fauci, who's really one of the most knowledgeable people in this country. And his view, and the view of many others, is that the information on these two drugs is anecdotal. That means there's some promising anecdotal information, but it's not from a clinical trial, and it's not really yet to the point where there's any evidence that these drugs are effective. We need to take anecdotal evidence and put it into a clinical trial so that we know if these drugs can be effective. And certainly we don't want to be using drugs unnecessarily. There can be harm to these medicines and their costs. So I think it's better to let the science lead on what treatments are effective and really listen to our National Institutes of Health and the researchers who are going to let us know what treatments in a very carefully clinical controlled trial are likely to be effective. I wouldn't take anecdotal information and go out and try and get a prescription to either of these medicines.
And the scary thing there is I'm seeing accounts of people who take those medicines for conditions they are proven for, tested for. Now, because of the talk of these as a hypothetical coronavirus treatment, they're not able to get the medicines that they actually need, and we know they work.
Yeah, and to go back to your first caller, there's so much misinformation out there. I just recommend that people go to credible sources, go to the CDC or your state or local health department, and really identify your sources from well-known and well-regarded organizations, and not just from a Facebook posting that you might have seen.
Thanks for that call. Dr. Patrick Remington is with us, Professor Emeritus at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, with us to answer some of your questions about COVID-19. Still time for you to join in with your question at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how the coronavirus and COVID-19, how it spreads, the symptoms, the testing? Are you wondering how the healthcare system is responding? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Dr. Patrick Remington, Professor Emeritus at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, answering your questions about COVID-19 and the novel coronavirus that causes it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Briefly, Dr. Remington, before we go back to our callers, one thing that's tricky in some cases with selling the need for social distancing is that, if I'm understanding this correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, the things we're doing today are going to pay off or not in 10 to 14 days. What we're seeing now with the spread all has to do with what we did 2 weeks ago. Do I have that right?
Yes, absolutely. The virus from the point of infection takes about 4.5 to 5.5 days to develop illness. And then that person, once ill, I actually was shedding virus prior to symptoms. So anything we do today is really going to be seen downstream a week or two from now.
Let's go back to our callers. Andy is on the line in Marinette. Andy, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about, Andy?
Yes, I'm wondering. Okay, so I just came back from Chicago, which I know is a known hotspot. And I came back 2 weeks ago, which was a little bit ahead of the curve. I knew there was some issues, and I made the decision to self-isolate back then. And so I watched all of the activity around me deny that this was an issue and continue to go about their daily lives. And my question is, what is the exponential factor that we can expect from if we make a decision today to self-isolate or if we make a decision today to go out in public? How many people can we expect to show symptoms down the line if we don't change anything versus if we do?
Dr. Remington, what do you think?
Yeah. That's a great question. If all you have to do is open up a spreadsheet and practice this, just double a number. Within a month, taking a penny and doubling it every day, you're going to have over $20 million in a month. But do that with cases. Take a case and double it every 5 days, which is what we see, you'll have 10 million cases in 3 months. And so if we do nothing, it's well known that there will be millions of people dying in this country. And so that is really not an option. If we do a good job of social isolation, we're going to buy time. We might not prevent as many cases as occurring as we'd like, but we're going to buy time so those serious cases are able to get appropriate medical care. So there are hospital beds and ventilators, if necessary, available to them. If you continue going out and socializing as you did before, you're increasing the risk not only for yourself, but to transmit that disease to others. And we will exceed the capacity of hospitals to take care of really sick people. And so it really is important to be safe. to follow all the precautions that are being recommended. This is not an overblown response. This is the appropriate response given where we are today.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Ed now in Kearney, Michigan. Ed, hello. Ed, are you there? Doesn't sound like we have Ed. Let's switch over to Dean then in Rushford, Minnesota. Dean, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Hi,
hey, hey.
Thank you for taking my call. So, like I was speaking to you earlier, I live in southeast Minnesota, and I work over the river in Wisconsin. And it's just kind of disturbing, you know, the sentiment and just the overall attitude I get from people about this is that, you know, like, this is just another flu-like thing that, you know, it's going to come and go. And it's just, like, boggles me that we're not, that people aren't grasping the gravity of this. So I'm just wondering, you know, what can we do to really get people to understand the gravity of the situation? Because, I mean, you'd think with all the measures that, you know, we're trying to take now, people would understand. But it really, just from the people I deal with and I speak to, they just don't really understand what's going on. So it's kind of disturbing.
Dean, thanks for the call. A big part of this, I guess, is communication, Dr. Remington.
It is, and it's at both ends of the spectrum. I think we clearly need to convince people that this is not business as usual, that this is a very serious virus. It can kill 1 out of 5 people over 80 years of age, and it can also kill young people, although less commonly. It will become the leading cause of death in people in their 30s if we don't respond. So it is clearly a public health emergency, and we need to respond. Now, that being said, I think there are people who are very afraid and are maybe overreacting by not leaving their house, by not even going shopping and doing things that you can do safely. If you keep a distance from individuals and if you use safe hand washing and other practices, you can go about that business. But again, avoid large crowds. I think the stay-at-home order is a good way to see if we can buy some time to really bring this epidemic under control so that we make sure we have enough capacity within our hospitals and healthcare system to take care of people who will become really sick. We have not seen the end of this. It's still an epidemic in process.
Time for one more caller. Rick is with us in New Glarus. Rick, hello.
Hi, Pat. I've got a childhood acquaintance of yours from Dartmouth Road. I'm an ER doc. And on my ER doc sites, I'm seeing a lot of apprehension from staff, especially in the hardest areas in New York and California and Washington, having observed in Italy that the system has overwhelmed not only from equipment but personal and humanitarian or human resource side of this. How much are you aware of that, and what's your assessment of how the system, if it becomes more prevalent and it develops as we think it might, what's your assessment of the human resource side of this, nurses, doctors, and can we handle
it? Rick, thanks for the call. Dr. Remington.
Well, I think that's a good way to end this conversation. We need to really respect our people working at the front lines. Rick, you know, as an emergency medicine physician, and all the staff involved, those are the people who are really going into harm's way, exposing themselves to the risk of caring for these patients. And I have the greatest respect for people working at the front lines. We need to do everything we can to make sure that our behavior is helping them by staying away from other people, by reducing the chances of us ourselves getting sick, so that the healthcare providers can do the best job that they can. And we absolutely need to make sure that they have all the protective equipment and that they have all the support needed. And that partly is not being prepared is too bad, but it's even worse if we don't help people right now at the front line doing everything that we can.
Dr. Remington, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Dr. Patrick Remington, Professor Emeritus at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He was with us to help answer some of your questions about the novel coronavirus and COVID-19. You can keep submitting your questions by emailing ideas@WPR.org, or you can go to WPR.org and click on Why Wisconsin. Leave your questions there. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, if you're feeling anxious about the coronavirus and the impact it's having on you, your family, and society at large, Dr. Richard Davidson of the Center for Healthy Minds joins the show with some advice on staying calm and getting a handle on our anxiety. That and more, it's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 8:30, if you're looking for great educational resources for kids in a time of school closures, our friends over at PBS Wisconsin have you covered. Kate and her guests dig into the learning opportunities available on public television here in the state. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll hear what listeners around the state have to say about how the novel coronavirus has affected their daily lives and how their community is dealing with it. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.